Good morning and welcome to the Monday call brought to you by NZ Funds. I'm Stefan Clark, Chief Client Officer at NZ Funds, and I'm joined today by Mark Brooks, Senior Principal and Head of Income. After easing from a peak of 7.3% last year to 5.6% at the last print, we are slowly winning the war on inflation. Investors, households, employers, and many others are focused on the path from here. This week, we're joined by KiwiBank's Chief Economist, Jared Kerr, to discuss current economic data, including the recent inflation print. We will be asking when the Reserve Bank can start reducing the OCR, how resilient is the New Zealand economy, is unemployment increasing, will the recent election have any impact, and what might a turn in the cycle mean for asset values such as property and the New Zealand share market. Jared, fantastic to have you here. So it's been a while. I was actually looking back, it was sort of 15 months or so ago that you last joined us, and a heck of a lot has happened in the meantime, including losing the World Cup. Let's kick off with inflation. At a high level, are you a believer that it can be put back in the box?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. It just a matter of how long and how much pain do we have to go through to get there. I think we were kind of hoping that inflation would be a little lower now. You know, when we last spoke, you know, 15 months ago, inflation's definitely surprised us on the high side. And I think going into next year, there's still some frustrations there. You know, oil prices have spiked recently with the war in the Middle East. And there's a lot of price pressures still bubbling away, but I think, you know, central banks globally are going to win the war. They have to, and they're going to do whatever it takes to get inflation back down, you know, towards 3%. And I think the move from 7.3, as you mentioned, down to 5.6, it's been relatively easy. A lot of that is global inflation having come off quite a lot over the last year. That next move to sort of 4%, I think, is almost baked in the cake. What we're interested in is, you know, can we get that 4% number back down to 2%? And I think that's going to be the more difficult move with what we're seeing in the underlying data. So they'll definitely get us there. There's no question on that. It's just how long and how hard it takes us to get there.
Righto. Why is it so? I mean, going back to first principles for a moment, why is it so important that we get it down to 2% and 3%? What is the economic driver for that? And why are central banks so focused on putting it back in the box?
Yeah. So New Zealand was the first central bank globally to properly target inflation, you know, coming out of the 70s and 80s, where, you know, inflation was a big problem. We focused on it and said, you know, we want price stability, and then over time, price stability by most central banks around the world is kind of a 2% run rate in inflation. You know, it's relatively stable. It's not causing any harm at sort of 2%. You know, inflation at 7.3% that we've just seen, you know, causes a lot of harm, particularly for savers. So the idea is that, you know, you can suppress inflation pressure, keep it, you know, nice and steady, and that enables businesses to make, you know, better decisions, not having to worry about inflation running at very high or even very low levels. Sort of remind listeners that over the last 15 years, we've kind of had inflation running at the low point, and we've only just over the last couple of years seen inflation spike to levels not seen since the 1980s.
Yeah. And at the same time, there's a lot of government spending, a lot of demand for infrastructure. And so that's naturally an expansionary driver. How do you feel with the new government probably coming in soon that that's going to change the inflation outlook and the, you know, when spending is so high?
Yeah, so the government does add to demand in the economy when they spend more. as you pointed out, and that can become problematic depending on the type of spending. But even infrastructure spending, which is what we desperately need because we've underinvested for a long time, even that adds demand to the economy and can add to inflation pressure. And there's a few things that are going on that, around the cyclone we had earlier in the year and trying to rebuild from that. It is adding to the economy. It is adding to inflation pressure. But we've kind of put ourselves in a bad space where we have underinvested in infrastructure for a very long time. And if we don't do it now, then we're just kicking the can down the road again and again and again. And there's a lot of productivity gains, I think, to be made from investing in infrastructure, getting our infrastructure where it should be, but then also thinking about where New Zealand needs to be with solid population growth forecast, forever. We need to spend more on the infrastructure. That's the good spending. I don't mind a bit of inflation coming out of there, but too much government spending, across the board, I think that needs to be addressed. And I do think the new government will be coming in with a fresh set of eyes, and they've explicitly said that they're going to try and cut back on some of the less important spending and trying to allocate a bit more funds to the infrastructure, which is what we need.
Does that sort of suggest that sort of a slightly higher level of government spending, along with some of the other structural forces out there, like sort of deglobalization, bringing inventories closer to home at the at the minimum, and then the sort of decarbonization spend that's going on, that we're probably in a world where inflation is likely to bubble away more than we've seen over the last sort of decade or two?
Yeah, I think you've raised a couple of really good points there. If we are in a deglobalization world, I'm not convinced we are, but the percentage of trade that we're doing is definitely plateauing and looking like it's coming off. And that onshoring, that trying to come up with a stronger, a bit more diversified supply chain, and potentially doing more onshore, that is inflationary. China, is not as deflationary as it once was.
Even
But
though their sort of PPI inflation is actually negative at present, and
yeah, so the PPI is negative. The CPI is at zero, but we're not getting the disinflation from China that we did over that, particularly the 90s period, I guess is what I'm thinking of. When China really opened up and started to become the global manufacturer, based on a lower cost base. We're not getting that again. To your point about onshoring and doing other things, it is inflationary. It does look like, we'll get inflation rates higher over the next decade than what we did over the last 10 to 15 years. And central banks will have that in mind.
So, without wanting to get too technical, does that suggest we've sort of got a higher neutral inflation, sorry, higher neutral interest rate going forward than what we've had over again over the last 10 or 20?
Yeah, potentially. There's an aging demographic in there, which has sort of kept things low, and I think that slowly reverses as well. So yeah, it looks like the Reserve Bank had the neutral rate at about two, and they're saying it's now sort of 2 to 3, which I think is about right. So interest rates at that sort of 2 to 3 level are no longer restrictive or stimulatory, and that goes, to your point there about all those bits and pieces bubbling away in the background. The other thing I'd probably raise is that we're going through, we're starting to go through a massive, I think, boost in technology with the introduction of AI. So that could be quite deflationary, but we'll have to wait and see. So there are forces going both ways.
Amongst economists, particularly in New Zealand, but in other countries too, there's been quite a lot of discussion and different perspectives on the impact of migration on inflation. And even among the bank economists and others in New Zealand, it seems to be quite a hot debate. What's your take on how much migration affects the inflationary, I guess, outlook and also economic activity more broadly?
So I guess I better answer like an economist would. You know, on the one side, you've got supply, and on the other side, you've got demand, and it's about, you know, which one wins. And I think we do have differing opinions around it. History is a good guide. We had the largest migration boom in New Zealand's history from 2013 to 19. That really did put downward pressure on wages. And how do we prove that? Well, why don't we close the borders and see what happens to wages after, you know, you stop migration? So obviously we had COVID for a period, and the labour market tightened up. We had to try and attract Kiwis into the workforce. We had to try and get Kiwis to do jobs that were otherwise taken by migrants. And, you know, we have seen, you know, wages tick up again. So we're looking at this, you know, from the supply side. We've basically imported 150,000 migrants over the last year, which is a record for us in 1 year. We lost 40,000 Kiwis offshore, but we've had this, you know, massive net gain of 110. That is a big increase in the supply of workers in the labour force. And you know, we're seeing already businesses telling us that the difficulty in finding workers, you know, is not as hard as what it was this time last year. So the conversations I've been having with our clients, a lot of SME businesses, you know, this time last year was all about, you know, I just can't find the workers, you know, that I need. I just, you know, we're paying up, we're increasing wages, we just can't attract the workers. Now you ask them what's going on, and they're more worried about the future, their future earnings, and other bits and pieces. They're no longer complaining about the ability to find workers, and that's a massive shift, and that's an increase in that in supply. But of course, people come here, and you know, they need to settle, they need to buy a car, they need to either rent a property or buy a house. They need to do, you know, X, Y, Z, you know, education for their kids, everything. They increase the demand for everything. We think that disinflationary force on wages is going to be a bit stronger than the extra inflation we'll get from them spending money. And the reason we're coming to that conclusion is because we do import younger people that, you know, they're generally aged 20 to sort of 35, but a lot of them are in their 20s, and they don't spend as much. So we're kind of thinking that supply side will beat the demand side on the migration, and will be, you know, a bit of a disinflationary force. But it's tough. We kind of have to wait and see as well.
So is that migration a key fact, do you think, or are there other reasons as to why, after sort of, you know, 5% of OCR increases, that the economy still seems stressed, but it's probably fairly, I wouldn't say happy. Happy is too strong a word, but it's coping.
Yeah, I guess coping is a good way to say it. I've been telling people that we're in quite an awkward period, which because you've got all these forces that are both hurting you, but also, you know, we're not seeing, you know, mass redundancies or you know, significant stress in our financial markets at all. The economy definitely has responded to higher interest rates. We started seeing it late last year in our spending data. So on the Kiwibank credit cards, we noticed that people were spending a lot more on essentials and getting less in volume terms. So having to spend more to get less. And then while that was going on, they pulled back spending on big ticket items. And we've seen, you know, household furnishings, for example, declining, you know, in the spending. So that, I think, tells you that yes, that big increase in interest rates has definitely had an impact, and clearly it's had an impact on our housing market as well, with house prices down. So there has been a material slowing in the Kiwi economy. We had a contraction at the end of last year. I think we're going to get a contraction now in economic activity. So, a pretty meaningful impact, but one that we hope doesn't lead to quite a sharp increase in unemployment. We think unemployment's going to increase from about 3.6 to about 5.5 next year. So, it's definitely being felt. Firms are telling us that they're actually looking to downsize rather than expand, which is what they're telling us last year.
Construction was such a huge part of the economy, well, for a very long time, and the lag between when you start a project and when you commence and complete the project is so significant. So I guess, and I'm sort of taking one step further from what you were saying, is I suspect that we just haven't seen it yet, but that's coming. As rates stay higher for longer, people will have to, businesses will start taking their foot off.
Yep, definitely. It's already happening, and we can see it. So, in the housing market, we've seen consents, come off. Not declining, sorry, but the number of consents coming down. So that's a pretty clear sign that the housing market turned. Talking to developers, last year they were already, reining back. They were finishing what they had, but they were, questioning the need to do that next project. We're not quite sure. We're not quite sure. Let's rein things back. From a bank's perspective, the beginning of last year, that sort of 2022, we were, coming up with lots of deals and lots of activity. Those deals haven't come through, so they're all approved, but quite a few deals just haven't gone through. And I put that down to the fact that interest rates have gone from 2.5, 3% to 7, 8%, and a lot of projects just don't make sense. So we've seen that on the housing side. We're also seeing it in the broader economy as well. Those decisions to expand, those decisions to build that extra factory or whatever, a lot of them have been put on the sideline.
This is a bit of a tangent, but does that suggest we might see some competition in, say, the mortgage space with banks? Because banks ultimately want to grow their book over time, and especially in an environment when there is a bit of inflation, there is that need to grow the lending book, and sort of says that, I don't think Kiwi banks alone, lending books are not growing and are pretty stagnant. So, when we get closer to possibly people believing that interest rate peak is here, do you think we'll see sort of more mortgage competition out there?
I think so. I mean, just thinking of it from us providing credit to the market as a whole, it depends what the demand's like, right? Do people want mortgages? Do people want these loans? And the demand for those loans, as you say, has cooled quite a lot from last year. So, we can heat up competition, but if people don't want the loans, then it's quite difficult, right? On the supply side, on our willingness to lend, I think banks as a whole have become a lot more conservative. With house prices falling the way they have, with the rapid rise in interest rates having quite a clear impact on our customer base, we can want to supply stuff, but it really is that demand side. And I think there are a few things that are changing. If we get that interest deductibility put back on, if we get maybe a watering down of the triple CFA, if Brightline, if the key bit is, as you mentioned, if interest rates look like they're going to head south, then I think that demand will pick up next year.
You mentioned earlier that durables particularly were not being bought as much as previously, and also that obviously you've sort of forecast 5.5 as the inflation unemployment rate. Where in the economy do you think more, you know, we're going to see the unemployment coming through?
Yeah, good question. I think it's more the interest rate sensitive parts of the economy that, you know, I think it is, you know, going to be housing related stuff. It's going to be, you know, broad based. We'll see some potential downsizing in agri and other areas as well, with the difficulty there and prices coming off. So I think it'll be broad based, but you know, those interest sensitive parts, I think we're seeing already, you know, around the fringes of the housing market. You know, that discussion on construction, you know, construction really had ramped up, but we're forecasting that to come off. So, you know, anything to do with the housing market, you know, construction as well, in pockets, although there's demand coming through in other areas, you know, around the cyclone, for example. But then I think more broad based as well, we'll see a slowing into next year. And we've got a bit of a keen eye on what's happening in agri space, right? If our, you know, farmers actually start to pull back even more, that has an immediate ripple effect through the economy.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned also a little bit before just about productivity, and with a new government coming in, are there any areas that you think this is the right time for us to be tackling our productivity problem? I think it's fair to say that New Zealand has not done a good job over the long run of improving our productivity levels. So
it's a discussion that's been pretty absent for a long time now.
And I remember the Productivity Commission, I think it was in 2008. And, you know, it hasn't really been on the table that much since then. So are there particular areas that you're hoping that the government will, the change in mindset will look at? And are there particular areas of opportunity which were low-hanging fruit that we should be going for?
Yeah, it's a good discussion. Our productivity hasn't looked very good at all, but you know, it's been a bit of a global issue, right? We don't actually look that bad compared to other countries, but it is disappointing. It has been a disappointing period for sure. You know, when economists talk about productivity, we talk about, you know, technology being a real you know, driver, education, these long-term strategies that really tackle your productivity. There's no quick fix. You know, we have these migration booms as well, which make our numbers look worse. But I think, you know, the longer term is, it really is that technology and education, you know, strategy. Like, what are we doing to make our economy harder, faster, you know, more resilient? And unfortunately, we're not doing enough. And it goes back to that infrastructure question, right? We have let ourselves down by underinvesting in infrastructure over the last 30 years. So it's not one government versus another. Both of them have underinvested for a very long time. We haven't actually maintained our infrastructure to where it should be, and we definitely haven't, you know, thought about future proofing and you know, really igniting this economy for the next generation. So for me, the best thing the government can do is tackle these infrastructure projects. You know, this infrastructure deficit that we have, you know, really needs to be tackled now. It's a bit more difficult today because interest rates are so high, but you know, we've been banging the drum on this for a very long time, and we haven't seen a meaningful shift of the needle. And I'm kind of hoping that the next government will you know, look at ways to really boost the infrastructure spending. To give you an idea, Treasury wrote a note quite a while ago. You know, for every dollar that we would spend on infrastructure, we could get two point seven going through the economy. The multiplier is that high. You think, oh, that's great, right? It's actually an embarrassment. It just shows that we've underinvested for so long that we get such a big return on whatever spending we do. So we're behind the eight ball. I think we really need to focus on if we want to get productivity better, the fact that it takes me 15 minutes to get out of my driveway and then 40 minutes to drive 10 Ks, you know, that's just not good enough, really.
Maybe a few more sinkholes will
kick. Yeah, well, that's,
I live next to one, so and Mark drives by one every morning, and it's a fresh reminder of
exactly
what can go wrong, and doesn't help the traffic when two of the lanes are gone. So,
in terms of unfortunately, as soon as you start talking about government spending for infrastructure, the discussion seems to rapidly change to debt levels, which to me seems like a red herring. And what's your view of sort of government debt levels in New Zealand? Good, bad,
I agree.
Different?
I agree. Red herring. So, you know, the sovereign, the government has very low levels of debt, very low levels by international comparisons, 20% of net debt, which is tiny. Australia's got 45, US is like 110 or something like that. UK is at a similar sort of level. Most European countries are around that sort of 80 to 100 plus level. And then you've got, our favorite debt country, Japan. It's got 260% debt to GDP, which is, you know, obviously off the charts. We could double our debt, and I don't think it would have a material impact on us. But you can also, set up little funds and say, this is an infrastructure fund. It's going to go out and get its own debt. And we're going to put a toll on that road that we're about to build, or we're going to do something else. And it could be backed by the government. So it's got that strong credit rating, but goes out and issues its own debt. And it's not caught up in election cycles. So there are so many ways that we could, fund the infrastructure that we need. That's not the problem. It's the political will. You can come up with great ideas like, Kiwi Build, we want to build 100,000 homes. Exactly. That is the shortage that we calculated in 2018. Our modelling suggests 100,000 shortage in homes. How many did they end up building?
1,000.
A handful. I think it was 1,000, 1,500, right? So unfortunately, the government is then that much more nervous to do things like this. That inability to actually deliver is the sad part. It really is, because the next government's going to go, well, geez, I don't want to make that mistake. Yeah, but we kind of need those ideas. Kiwi Bill was a good idea. Execution, unfortunately, not there.
In Australia, you see, your Transurbans and these big infrastructure businesses that run toll roads and other assets on behalf of their government, and it seems to work well.
Those private partnerships work. You get the businesses that know how to do it. You get them in to do it, and you provide as much support from a government level as you can. What I didn't mention, government doesn't have much debt. Councils are loaded up to their eyeballs. So this is a real issue in New Zealand. We need to use that government balance sheet, that strength of that to help fund all these projects. Councils, they can't do it. They don't have the money.
Yeah, people who know me know it's a bit of a pet subject that something like Auckland Council, that's five times levered to, for want of a better word, EBITDA. Anywhere else in the world, if that was a corporate, that would be a high yield junk credit. But gets a double A rating because of other issues.
Yeah.
So with that headroom that the government has, hopefully, or do you see them coming through and launching a push on infrastructure and the way that, it's hard to cut through when they're doing a lot of, lolly scrambles in the lead up to the election about what's going to be done. But, where do you see that going? Are we going to have, and then that'll obviously create another inflationary pulse through the system if we start doing a lot of new roads and all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I would like to see that, but I don't think we will. I think we'll see a an increase in infrastructure spending, which would be good, but we're not going to see this big leap and trying to do everything that we need to do at once, and that would be inflationary. But I do think it's needed. I think both governments have subscribed to this fiscal responsibility, which is in their minds keeping debt levels well below 30%, and that's a self-imposed handbrake right there. So yeah, we'll get a bit more debt coming through just because the economic numbers are going to be worse than what Treasury is forecast. Treasury is very optimistic in their forecast at the moment, so they'll be surprised on the downside, and then we'll end up issuing a bit more debt. But I don't think we're going to get these sorts of big increases in spending on infrastructure, which is what we need, but I don't think we'll get it.
And just coming back to your public-private partnership, we've got to give them a government credit. The fibre rollout is the perfect example of that, with Chorus and the local fibre companies. We do have some of the best internet in the world now, thanks to that process.
Yeah, exactly. There are blueprints out there, aren't there?
Yeah. Oh, well, if the government isn't going to be doing all of that, then it sort of plays into KiwiBank's expectations for the interest rate path from here. And I was looking at a chart that you guys sent out, and you are more dovish than some. And take us through, where do you think interest rates are going over the next couple of years?
And probably as a segue, as we talked before about how do you actually build that chart? You always sort of see that at economists have this nice curve, and just in lay terms, how you go about sort of stepping that out.
Yeah. So our forecast, we think that the cash rate has peaked at 5.5%. I think the last move that they made in May, that's it. I think it stays at 5.5%. We are optimistic on the inflation outlook. We are a little more dovish, as you say, than a number of economists out there. I do think we'll be right on direction, and that the next move for interest rates will be lower. Picking the timing of that is very hard and probably irrelevant, to be fair. Like, we're saying the first rate cut is hopefully going to come through in May. How did we come up with that? Well, it's basically looking at our forecast and saying, well, if the last move was in May this year, let's give them 12 months, basically. On average, it takes 9 to 10 months for the Reserve Bank to finish hiking and then start cutting again. There's no real science in that, but that's kind of how we feel things will turn out. How do we come up with that? With that curve, or it's basically just that, when are they going to start cutting, roughly? What's the direction? So the direction's lower. How fast are they going to cut? And we've got quite a slow, unusually slow rate cutting cycle from next year, because we think that push to 2 to 3% is going to be a little sticky and a little difficult. But basically, we come up with our forecast on the economy, and we forecast many things, but ultimately it feeds into a model that looks at what activity is going to do over the next little while. And activity started contracting late last year. We're expecting economic activity to fall over the next couple of quarters, and then to be quite weak next year. That is by RBNZ design. That's exactly what they want to see. That's exactly what their positioning interest rates to do, and then that feeds into our unemployment forecast, that feeds into our CPI inflation forecast, and we see inflation hitting 4% at the end of this year, and then getting below 3% next year. If we're going to be wrong, we're going to be wrong on maybe the international inflation. But potentially, some of the domestic inflation could prove to be stickier than we're hoping. So There are a lot of things that we forecast. We are economists. We love that stuff. Love playing with data. Love trying to predict the future. And then putting all that together, we come up with an interest rate track, which is based on what we think the Reserve Bank's going to do.
In terms of thinking about those probabilities, the one thing you haven't mentioned there is the risk that actually interest rates come down much faster than you expect. You know, if you look back through history, generally, you know, the move down in interest in short-term interest rates, OCR, Fed funds, etc., can tend to be quite sharp and swift when it does happen. Do you think there's, you know, much chance of that?
I do. Most of, I guess, the risk that people come to us is that, hey, you're calling for rate cuts. What if we see more rate hikes or on hold for longer? We don't often get asked about that downside risk. And I think that downside risk, I would put it 20, 25% chance, right? I think it's material. And as you say, when it comes to interest rates, we sort of go up the stairs and then we drop in the elevator shaft, right? So our forecast decline is very, very slow and unusual. So, you know, there is a big risk that once they start cutting, they could cut faster than we're forecasting. Absolutely. We're just kind of caught between what is probably a likely rate cutting path and also that kind of higher for longer bit.
Those sudden rate cuts tend to happen after something breaks.
Yep.
So after the GFC, for example, when you look at the chart there for, I guess, interest rates, it's the grinds upwards, up the stairs, as you say, something breaks, lemons or what have you, and then suddenly it's down we go. So
by definition, you never know what that is. But are there any areas of the local economy that sort of give you concern in that sense?
Well,
in pockets of sort of unexpected stress, I suppose.
From what we've seen so far, we've had a lot of phone calls from customers, you know, starting in sort of November last year. Hey, geez, my interest rate's gone from 2.5 to 5.5. Oh, now it's gone to 7, 7.5. We fielded a lot of you know, calls, as you would imagine, right? People make decisions on the price that they get, and they made decisions at 2.5, 3% interest rates, you know, a couple of years ago. They're rolling off now. We haven't seen a lift in defaults or a big lift in defaults because we haven't seen a big lift in unemployment. There is a risk there that things could turn uglier than we're forecasting. And if you want to stress test a bank, you use an unemployment rate. So when we're stress tested by the Reserve Bank, they give us a whole bunch of variables, but basically the unemployment rate is the big one. And if you think the unemployment rate's going from 3.6 to 5.5, that's not a big deal. If it goes from, you know, 5.5 to 7, you start seeing this exponential type lift. And if it goes to sort of 8, 9, 10, 11% like we got in the early 90s, then you see a lot more defaults coming through. And that is the downside, you know, risk. If we see, you know, a big lift in unemployment, we're going to get a big lift in defaults. We're already, I think, seeing signs of stress under people just having to pay a lot more on interest alongside the cost of living crisis and everything else that households are going through. I think the risk there is kind of, as you say, these interest expense bills are really mounting for households at the moment.
And it would seem that that's sort of been a two-step process. As you say, they've gone from 2.5 to 4.5, and now people are rolling from 4.5 to 7.5. Is that, it seems to be that what's happening in the RBNZ data. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the amount of the interest bill that customers are facing, you know, has doubled, and in some cases, you know, will nearly triple depending on you know what interest rate you got a few years ago. Right now, we had quite a big two-year campaign 2 years ago. So I think a number of banks had the similar sort of campaign about 2 years ago. They're rolling off now, literally now, over spring and summer. And that is actually quite a little lump on our balance sheet. So half of their balance sheet has rolled off, as you pointed to, and we already saw a contraction in activity on the back of that. The second half of our mortgage book is rolling off kind of as we speak, about 30% to year end, and then another sort of 10 or so percent after that. So the impact has been felt, you know, half of it has been felt, the other half is you know, in process.
Okay, so with your base case, you see interest rates coming down over the in 2024 in the second half, I think it was, starting off in Q3, perhaps late Q3. And then you see unemployment going up to 5.5%, which is still in the, it's an okay place to be as a country. What does it mean for asset prices if it plays out as in your version of the crystal ball gazing?
So I think right now, it's quite interesting for financial markets. You know, you've got this, you know, we've got some good news coming through. Oh, but that's bad news because they're gonna hike more or hold for longer. And then you get some bad news coming through, and oh, does that mean that, you know, we've got the peak in interest rates and they're about to fall? So it's we're at that point. And you mentioned about something breaking. You know, a lot of people talk about the Fed always hiking until something breaks. We thought something broke earlier in the year when the SVB Bank and a few others went belly up. Now that the you know, interest rates in the US, you know, that 10-year rate's getting to 5%, people are thinking that's gonna cause, you know, significant pain and something might break. So I think it'll be interesting to see how financial markets work their way through. But for me, I'm an interest rate strategist by heart, so I do focus on the rates markets, and I think the next big move for rates is actually going to be what we call a bull steepening, where, you know, short end rates that they push lower quite quickly as central banks turn around and say, you know, we're pivoting now, we think we've done enough to beat inflation. Next move's a rate cut. When they say that, we're going to get a big move in rates markets globally. And I think that's the move for next year. It'll be the rates market that leads. You will get, hopefully, quite a decent move in rate space. And then equity markets will sort of take a breather and go, oh, our discount factors are a little lower. You know, this is a bit more pro growth from central banks, and we'll see equities. You know, if the interest rates move, we'll see equity markets really move. And then to other assets, you know, Kiwi's favorite asset. I think there's a few things working, but that shift in interest rate expectations will be the big driver for the housing market. Once investors become confident that interest rates are declining, I think we'll see a bit of a bounce there. And then we've talked about migration. We do have this supply demand shortfall in housing. So we've just added another, you know, 100 plus thousand people, but we haven't added the 40, 50,000 homes that we need for them. So yeah, that those, you know, property will pick up as well. Commercial property might be slightly different in different areas, but you know, broadly speaking, interest rates heading south will help that market as well.
New Zealand was quite early to lift interest rates going into it. And so, you know, one perspective is we move faster than many other countries. And that might play out again here if you know, your case sort of that, your models play out in the way they do. Are there other countries outside of New Zealand where you're seeing it looking like they're coming towards the end of the tightening cycle?
I think most countries are coming to the end of the tightening cycle. We saw the ECB, European central bank pause last week. That's the first time they've paused since they started hiking last year. Bank of England, you know, probably next move is going to be a rate cut. The Fed, very difficult. Maybe we get another hike out of them. Maybe another two, but, you know, probably peaking this year. Next move, you know, down, whether it's late next year or in 2025, I think that discussion will be pulled forward. And then you look at the RBA. RBA were a lot slower than the RBNZ, about 6 months slower, and they've only got their cash rate to 4.10. So I think we may see another rate rise from them as early as next week. You know, but that will be probably about their last as well. So I think most central banks will be looking to call the top and then waiting to see what inflation does. And if inflation eases the way we hope it will, then, you know, most central banks will be on a cutting path. So we're quite synchronized in our movements, you know, central banks. Reserve Bank of New Zealand, one of the first to hike. So we think they may be in a position to be one of the first to go the other way. In fact, that's what we're calling.
And in terms of that thought process, how much is domestic versus that external impact? You know, how much time do you spend as an economist thinking about, well, what's happening in Australia, what's happening in China, what's happening in the US, and what does that mean for us?
I spend a lot of time, actually. I think if you're covering New Zealand, you've actually got to start offshore. We're a tiny, tiny, like Australia, tiny little open country with a large export sector. So, you know, if you look at our history, most shocks that we've gone through have started overseas. And, you know, we get these big terms of trade shocks where our export prices move quite dramatically relative to our import prices, and that can put big pressure on our economy. So we start offshore. If we're to be, you know, clinical about it, we've got a CPI basket where a little less than 50% of our basket is international prices. So what's happening overseas, and the other little bit over half is domestically generated. So that tradables part was what blew up. We saw prices increase, and that came through. We're now seeing international prices coming off, and I think we'll actually see them decline next year. So it'll be a bit of a source of deflation, and then we're really focused on what the domestic inflation outlook is like. So yeah, we put a big weight on what's happening in the global economy, and you can see it. You know, it comes through in our dairy prices, how important that is.
Some people have been arguing quite forcefully that China will export deflation again, and I assume you'd start seeing that, or one would start seeing that, and the emerging economies around China first, where they are, you know, a larger portion of their economies are trading, you know, are its trading partners. So, but at least I haven't seen anything to support that yet, but maybe you have.
Look, I think over a longer term, China's just not going to be the source of you know, disinflation or deflation that it used to be. It's just not. China's got its own problems. Their population has peaked, and it's an aging population. It's going to be one that's, you know, quite difficult to get growing at the rates that we're used to out of China. I think the focus will and should shift to countries like India and other countries in Asia. We need to diversify our exports. You know, we've got a fantastic trading partner in China, and they're our largest trading partner, but we need to look elsewhere to get the growth that we need, I think, over the next decade. And I think India is going to sort of move higher and higher and higher as a percentage of our total exports, you know, going forward. So China is a big story, but I think the next story is not China. It's the broader Asia group, and then eventually we'll look to maybe a few countries in Africa. But, you know, Asia's still got heaps of growth India's population doesn't peak until 2070, for example. It's very young. There's a lot of growth, a lot of potential out of India relative to China.
I was going to say that's probably a segue into that question economists always hate. One asset class we haven't talked about is Kiwi, the New Zealand dollar. Thoughts on that?
Ah, see, this is me. I'm more of a financial markets person. I love talking Kiwi. How long have we got here? Let's from my point of view, the Kiwi. There's a few main drivers of the Kiwi over time. That the terms of trade that I mentioned before, particularly our export prices. What's happening there? Defines the Kiwi a bit. We call the Australian dollar and the New Zealand dollar and the Canadian dollar. We call them commodity currencies, right? And it's because we export big commodities. So what's happening with our export prices? Well, we've seen, dairy come off, has bounced back a little bit, but it's come off. A lot of our export prices have really, weakened. So that's put a bit of downward pressure on Kiwi. And then the next thing we think about is interest rate differentials. So what interest rate are investors getting in New Zealand relative to the United States? And, we normally offer a higher interest rate because we've got a little bit more growth and a weaker perceived credit rating. So, that's actually narrowed quite a bit. And to take on the risk of the Kiwi currency, which is highly volatile, it's the most volatile of the largest traded currencies, you need a bit more, to be fair. You need a bit more. You're getting similar interest rates in the US than you are in New Zealand, and you're not being compensated for that risk, as far as I'm concerned. So my forecast for the Kiwi is to drop to 55 cents. It's been our forecast since last year. We're sort of sticking to it. We think it's slowly on that path, and it'll sort of languish around those sorts of levels for a while into next year. It is what we need from our exporters' point of view. Fonterra would love a weaker Kiwi because they receive dollars. But in terms of that inflation fight, it's not going to help.
To flip that around, does that suggest you're still relatively positive the US dollar? Because obviously Kiwi is, there's 99%, it's probably too aggressive, 90% driven by where the US dollar goes.
Yeah. So I think that the Fed, we may have another rate rise or two out of them by year end. We are seeing, reasonable turns in the US data. Labor market's still very strong. So that relative story of the US versus us versus the rest of the world, I think points to a bit of dollar strength, as you say. So that should be Kiwi weakness. That's the same story if you're looking at the Aussie dollar or others. So yeah, bit more dollar strength, and that'll hopefully push the Kiwi a little lower, which is good for the export sector.
All right, coming into Christmas soon, aren't we? And what do you think our listeners should focus on in terms of key data points? What are the big sort of one or two data points that you think everyone should be looking at?
Okay, so thinking of it as if you're the Reserve Bank, really, you look at what we call a Phillips curve. You look at what unemployment rates or underutilization rates or the labor market is doing, and then inflation. And those are the key data points. So out this Wednesday, we've got the employment report. We are expecting to see the unemployment rate lift. If we see that sort of lift a little further over coming quarters, then the Reserve Bank will take that as a good thing. It's very hard for the Reserve Bank to come out and say we want to see people losing their jobs. They simply won't say that, but it's kind of what they need to see. They need to see that loosening up in the labor market to point to a reduction in wage pressure, and that brings us to the inflation numbers. So any data on prices. I think we're going to see some very heavy discounting to run down inventories into Christmas. So I think that there'll be a disinflationary force coming through, and hopefully, you know, the next readings on inflation are much lower than where they were a couple of weeks ago. So I think those are the two key, really. You look at your labour market, everything washes out on the labour market and the inflation outlook as well.
Fantastic, Jared. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a really interesting conversation, and it's great to get a bit more detail around your forecasts for interest rates and get in the direction of employment market, among all the other things we've talked about. And hopefully we'll have you back on the call, not in 15 months, but maybe a bit sooner. So, and probably a little bit less will have transpired and as it has over the last for us.
Yes, thank you for inviting me on.
Awesome. Have a good week.
Cheers.
Cheers.
This has been the Monday Call, brought to you by NZ Funds. New Zealand Funds Management Limited is the issuer of the NZ Funds KiwiSaver Scheme, the NZ Funds Managed Superannuation Service, the NZ Funds Advice Portfolio Service, the NZ Funds Wealth Builder, and NZ Funds Income Generator. A product disclosure statement for each is available at nzfunds.co.nz. Past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future returns.